Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, Heritage Radio Network has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Raj Vaidya and Daniel Johns. Johns did that on purpose. See if you're awake. We're going to talk to Raj and Daniel about wine, La Fête du Champagne, La Table, La Paulet, Pressoir, and more. We're going to taste what looks like a big treat here. The guys brought in a 20-year-old Cote Roti, which we'll talk about in a few minutes for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Daniel Johns is a true wine hero. He spent 4 decades in wine and hospitality with Daniel Boulud and Drew Nicoron at New York's finest restaurants. A true Francophile, Daniel has shared and promoted his love of French wine with all of us. He has received 2 Chevalier Medals of Merit from the French government and is also a James Beard Award winner. At the Grape Nation, we like to say, we bring wine to the people. Well, Daniel has become the greatest example of that by way of his wine fêtes or festivals, La Paulet, La Fête du Champagne, La Table, his pressoir wine experiences, and also as an importer. Jersey born, Bombay raised, Singapore.
All of those.
Who knows, all over the place. Raj Vaidya's love of Burgundy, Champagne, and Rhone wines eventually brought him together with Daniel Johns. No coincidence. Raj is a highly accomplished sommelier and the director of operations for Pressoir. Before Pressoir, Raj worked at the finest wine restaurants in the country, including even New Jersey, the Ryland Inn, Crew, Gary Danko, and ran the wine program for a dozen years with Daniel Boulud. Raj and Daniel are gearing up for La Fête du Champagne, October 25th through the 28th in New York City. And correct me if I'm wrong, November 3rd and 4th in Houston?
That's correct.
Okay. So October 25th, I think, is today. So we got to get going. All right, guys. Welcome back to the Grape Nation. It's great to have you here. I'm excited to have both of you. I just want to warn people that because Daniel is in the thick of things, he's going to run out a little early, and Raj is going to hang with me. We're talking to Raj and Dan at the Heritage Radio Network Studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at Roberta's Pizza, of which we had a little
delicious
before we got the show started. So if you hear any burping or anything, that's from the bee sting. All right. Before we talk about the upcoming events, which timing wise is really why, you know, I ask you guys to come here, I want to tap into your wine expertise, specifically about Champagne, Burgundy, and Rhone too. So let's start with Champagne and Burgundy. Both are classic wine growing regions. And I would say have gone through a lot of change in the last few decades. Climate change is now an issue. Generational change is right in front of us. The grower movement in Champagne, you know, is there. So let me start with generational shifts and new wineries. In addition to new wineries and winemakers, are you seeing that shift as a significant thing in both regions?
Well, we're still here, everybody.
Yeah.
Just want to remind you, Sam, you've done your homework. Thank you for that wonderful introduction for both of us. That was great. To answer your question, I'm going to say yes, but I want to throw you off your program.
Please do.
I want to throw you off a little bit, your schedule of topics to talk about, because I want to start by saying how proud I am to be working with Raj for the last several years, came on board, and also for the rest of our team. We have an amazing organization with the festivals and Pressoir. Pressoir handles restaurant consulting and seller consultation for collectors. And we have a lot going on. We have an amazing organization. I'm really proud to be working with such talented people. Some of them live in Boston and in France and Boone and even New Jersey. And it's really great to be surrounded by such talent and passionate people. So well, I want to start out by saying
I think after, you know, we're done talking, anyone who's attended the events or anyone who listens to this podcast and understands what you're doing realizes it does take an organization. And it's nice of you. And I know how important Raj is and Edward and, you know, handful of people, and then everyone else that works with you. It's nice for you to say that, because there's a lot of moving parts here, you know. So it's thank you for saying that. Anything else to that point?
Well, I mean, you know, we really cover the world of wine, French wine. We're all Francophiles, and that starts with me having lived in France and really developed my palate for French wine. You know, we touch on all topics, French-related, French wine-related. And I have to say that what's really important to us is the culinary angle to what we do also, because we love food, we love chefs who love wine, and we can't really appreciate the greatness of wine without great food. So we take it very seriously.
Wine is at its best.
Well, it shows the wine in its best light, and it shows the food in its best light also.
Right.
And I started my career wanting to be a chef. I gave up on that early on. That wasn't my path. But I just want to tip my hat to all the chefs who love wine and who collaborate with us. It's really important.
Yeah, I like that. And at your events, the level of chefs is off the charts. Raj, you know, Daniel has declared himself a Francophile. Is it fair to say early on that was you too, or are you a little more all over the place in a good way?
I think it's fairly safe to say. early in my career, I had, of course, broader interests, as anyone does, young and interested in wine. It's such a big world to try and become familiar with, let alone try and approach mastery. But I started out loving wines from Germany and Champagne very early. And so I think it's safe to say Francophilia was already running rampant. And I fell in love with Burgundy very early. Daniel had already been promoting it for, you know, more than a couple of decades by the time I was old enough to start buying and selling those
Talk
wines.
Talk about generations.
Yeah. Well, you started young and so did I. So
at lunch we were talking about, you know, I want to talk to you about, you know, tell my people how they could find values in Burgundy and, you know, new regions. And, you know, it was clear that you were there before there was any issue about accessibility or unreasonable pricing, you know, and now we're here at a point where, I mean, one of the functions of these festivals is to be able to access and, you know, taste all these things at a reasonable price.
Well, it's twofold, the access to be able to taste the producers that have become harder to access, harder to taste, harder to meet with, but also to promote the region as a whole. I mean,
right.
Daniel, I don't know when you first started including in the program of La Palais, the sort of petite wines of Burgundy by way of the off-grid tasting.
Yeah.
But that's long been one of my favorite tastings, where we assemble about 100 wines that are exactly those discovery areas, you know, not the Von Romanée, but the Haute Côte, not Chassin-Montrachet, but the Chalonnay. Yeah. So really bringing those wines to people.
At one point we used to say, yeah, that Saint-Aubin was like a discovery area. Now it's mainstream. It's really good. But now you're talking about even far beyond the Haute Côte and Côte de Dijon. And
I want to talk to you about that, but I want to follow up on two things. Is there a noticeable generational change? Like, you've been in ad of Burgundy, you know, walking the vines with people. Is that change very noticeable? Has it been gradual? Has that time come? You know, is it going to have any different impact on the Burgundy?
I think there's a noticeable
change
in Burgundy. I think it's fantastic. There's so much energy in Burgundy today. And it's come with the change of generations of
succession,
from the father, mother, the family to the next generation. And the next generation is traveling. They're friends with people in other regions. They're interested in, very, very interested in the climate change and how to deal with that in their vineyards, whether it be organic, biodynamic, regenerative, all kinds of attention. And I find it an extremely dynamic region today.
Is there still room for, besides somebody taking over generationally, have you seen new wineries and winemakers pop up that, impress you? I mean, that falls under the category you just said, where they're more thoughtful farming practices, making good wines.
The new wineries have to find a way to do it because the land is so expensive. They cannot buy land in the main vineyard area of Burgundy, the Côte d'Or, the mainstream appellation, Chambon, Musigny, Von Romanée, Chèvre. But they find ways to do it. Either they have fine investor or they go into the Haute Côte or regions that are less expensive, more affordable. There's some fantastic, and working with different grape varieties that weren't as popular, such as Aligoté. Today, Aligoté is hot.
So Aligoté, you would find a little outside of the crew vineyards of Burgundy. Is it north, south?
Well, historically, Corton was planted to Aligoté.
It was
a more lauded and appreciated variety historically. Fell a little bit out of favor, and generally Chardonnay would take a higher price. So those places which were planted to white were often grafted over or planted over to Chardonnay post-phylloxera. But today, I think it's twofold. First, the interest in wines that have freshness and brightness. Aligoté naturally has higher acidity,
so stylistically
expresses higher acidity in that region. But also because there's a general interest in value, and in general, most Aligoté, outside of a handful that are extremely expensive,
so
tend to be
offered the grape.
Value. Yes, Aligoté is a grape.
Yeah.
Talk to me, about characteristics, and in that climate and in those soils, it's suited well.
Right. Well, generally, I just drink Montrachet and Chevalier Montrachet, but
I guess I'm the Aligoté drinker at the table.
Should I kick him out early?
Just kidding. Come on. Hey, listen, remember we went to Le Soleil in 70?
Yes.
And Lola served us that Aligoté from Ami?
Yes, I do remember.
And I was like, I'm not really sure. And we ended up drinking two bottles of it.
Drank a bottle and a half. I had a glass. And then when I reached for a second glass, which was out of the second bottle, it was all gone. So,
when you talk about
Aligoté,
not every Burgundy maker is making Aligoté.
No.
There are certain people that are specializing it. Is like one of them, Sylvain Pate.
I can give you a bit of a primer on it. So Aligoté still generally planted outside of the main village premier cru areas of the Côte d'Or.
All the famous names.
So you'll typically see it in the Haute Côte. You'll see it in the flatlands on the other side of the Route Nationale. So the lower rent areas, so to speak, by no means cheap anymore, but still, historically that was because they were less important places. So Aligoté did fine there because you could only sell Aligoté for so much. Today it's kind of interesting because the combination of the naturally more acid driven palate of an Aligoté with the cooler climate in the Haute Côte at the top of the hill is very refreshing and appealing and compelling to modern palates, I think. And also when compared with these warm vintages and global warming and the effects it's had on the region, the freshness of Aligoté has become more compelling, I think, for
I'd like to add also that it was a grape variety that was overproduced and it was considered very thin and acidic, and that's where the cure came from, right? To put a little creme de cassis in there to make it palatable. But in fact, there are some very old vine Aligoté that when they're treated properly and reasonable yields make a very compelling wine.
That's not an uncommon story in wine. There were regions where the grape is pretty good, the vines were great, and they just made crappy commodity wines, you know, whether it was Orvieto or, you know, some of these other places. What about, so do I make you uncomfortable if I say, give me a couple of good Aligoté producers? I will stay away from that if that's
the case.
No, no,
I think that's easy. Daniel, you mentioned AMI. This is a small winery, A-M-I, as in France.
Okay.
We got turned onto it at one of our favorite restaurants, which is in 70 Les Bonnes, owned by the Bees family. And as Daniel said, he managed, it was so delicious that it disappeared quickly.
They
it's
don't
imported
make
here in the U.S. and Zevero Vine Selections, your neighbor here in Bushwick,
right around the corner,
brings it in. And the wines are spectacular and they're a great value. You mentioned Sylvain Pataille, who's kind of the to some degree, the master or the historic master of bringing it to the forefront, especially in Appellation status. He makes a number of single vineyard wines that are Aligoté that I think are spectacular and still very well priced for the quality of the wine and the overall quality of Burgundy. Yeah. I would point out Pierre Moret. And Moret is making a wine that I bought absolutely every year. I seeked it out amongst the other fancy appellations that are sold. I'd get an allocation of wines from, you know, Meursault, Batard, Montrachet, and I'd say, can I please have two cases of Aligoté at
least?
That's
cool.
Because it aged really well.
It's great that he mentions Moret because they're known for their Meursault and their Batard, right. Montrachet, but then Aligoté,
right.
So-called lesser grape variety, is fantastic. And then others like...
Does like, a Chanterie like make
Michel
great
Lafarge.
Wine?
I mean, Michel Lafarge.
Lafarge.
They make a great, great
Aligoté and other great
wines. D'Angerville. I mean, a lot of people have Aligoté planted and make it.
And you mentioned Chantreuve. Chantreuve is following in the footsteps of Pataille. Again, this is a great example of an answer to the question you had about new wineries and new winemakers. This domain is relatively new and they've had to start out with what they could get their hands on. You know, they don't have massive funding. They can't buy Chassagne or Meursault. And so they're making a series of single vineyard Aligotés that are absolutely delicious. And really
so powerful. I want to say a couple of things because I'm going to have to leave.
Answer this question first.
Okay.
And see if it works. And when you're talking about Aligoté being good value and some of the new winemakers and, you know, it grows well there, is something like the Mâconnais in the mix? Is that an area where, you know, are they?
Aligoté is planted all over that region, but also
what
Chardonnays
else?
From Mâcon and Chardonnay are absolutely
Are you
going to
find values in the Mâconnais that you may not find?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
So Aligoté, Aligoté from the Mâconnais, other wines from the Mâconnais. Before you answer,
no, but what I want to say,
go ahead.
What I want to say is that what we do at our festivals and at pressoir events and everything, we actively seek out some of these lesser known regions that provide good value, young producers who are making great wine. Because the big names that we all love and look for as much as we can, sometimes they're out of reach in the pocketbook, but also you can't find them. And we think that it's important to promote the next generation, the young producers, the lesser known appellations. At all of our festivals, we have sections of the program dedicated to that.
Right.
And we feel it's really important.
You do have events that are accessible in price, and some of these have 20, 30, 50 different, you know, winemakers or options, which is terrific. I got to let you go in 1 second, but we do a thing. We have 2 minutes.
You got to taste the wine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Start pouring it. So we do a thing called the wine list. Every week I've done it, you know, almost 300 times. I ask my guests 5 questions. You don't have time for 5 questions. But Raj, I'm going to do the full thing with you and we'll compare it to your last one.
Okay.
So the question I'm going to ask you of the 5 is your favorite all-time wine. When I asked that question, you were the perfect guy because you were the perfect guy because you were in the business. You were around collectors. You were around expensive wines. So what was like the most expensive rare ball and wine you ever had? I don't give a crap about that answer anymore. the answer I care about is, what is that wine today that you look back that had the most impact on you, that was a gateway, that changed the way you thought, that still resonates with you? Is there a wine or two that you can remember, either when you were a kid or maybe 5 months ago?
There are a lot of wines, but when I was just getting into it, and what really opened my eyes, my palate to it, was a Rhone wine. It was a 1976 La Mouline from Gigal. And I went into a shop and I was looking for a bottle of wine to bring to a Thanksgiving dinner. And a person recommended it and said, it's a little pricey, but maybe you'd like to try it. It was a 76 La Mouline for $30. Okay. I said, yeah, well, I know it's a little pricey, but I'm going to go for it. And you know what? It worked really well with the turkey.
when was this?
You still remember that?
It was around 1984.
So it's like less than 10 years old.
It was like 82, 83.
But that's the point of the question. That wine you still remember, and it just was a memorable.
And then more recently, the wine that is, you know, look, Raj and I and the people we work with are like incredibly passionate, always discovering. 1937 Romani Conti, not too long ago.
The wine was good.
Wow.
That was good.
It was still
on that note
holding up. All right. So wait, quickly on your exit, just tell me what we're drinking. I always ask my guests to bring in a wine that's representative of what they're doing. You're doing the La Table Rhone Festival. You brought in a 20-year-old Cote Rote. Quickly tell me about the vintage year, the producer, and Cote Rote.
Well, 03 was hot everywhere, but this is from a producer, Clouzel Rock. The only certified organic producer, although maybe there's another certified producer of organic.
It's the oldest, and now there's a couple.
But in Cote Rote, lovely family in Varennes up on the northern part. And this is a cuvée called the Grand Place. Grand Place is one of their larger holdings, very high altitude up on the plateau. It always makes a well-structured wine. Raj and I opened this earlier just to test it, especially from a hot vintage like this. It always has some tannins, but it's drinking beautifully today.
It is great.
Absolutely love it. And it's a small producer. They started out when I met them, 3.5 hectares. Now the son is, Guillaume, is running the domain. I think he's up to like 12 hectares.
I've met him at your La Table.
And he's going to be here in a few short weeks.
All right. So that was Daniel Jonas. We have to let Daniel go because he's a very busy guy. Raj is going to stay with us. Thank you, Daniel. I hope to see
you
this weekend. Good luck with everything. Raj and I are going to talk about the remainder of the events. Thank you for coming in. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Raj Vadhia.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Okay, we're back. We just said goodbye to Daniel Jonas. Daniel's on his way to get things going for La Fête du Champagne. I'm here with Raj Vadhia. Raj, before we get into the festivals, I want to ask you a few more things about wine. You travel pretty extensively to Burgundy. I mean, I follow you on Instagram, and I see all over the place.
So you see all of the dogs I get to play with?
Yeah, well,
Burgundy,
you're
all the grocery stores I get to go to.
You and Icy. Do you know Icy Lou?
I do know Icy.
You're the only two who post dogs and vineyard dogs regularly. And, you know,
they're
dogs.
Not all,
Dogs that obviously, you know, move you or you connect with.
All dogs move me.
And, yeah. Dogs don't.
Primarily if they're other people's dogs, of course.
People don't deserve dogs. And you also travel, which we'll talk about a little later in the show, you know, with scholarship candidates and winners, which is interesting. But when you travel, and I see you out in the vineyards a lot, a small group of people, usually the winemaker, the owner, talking. When they get beyond the immediate thing they're talking about, which could be those vines, that varietal, that plot, you know, the facing or whatever. I mean, what else is on their mind? I mean, is climate change?
What the hell am I doing there over and over again? What am I talking about?
Not you, them. What are they, you know, what are their concerns? Is climate change something they're accepting and managing, or?
Well, let's speak a bit about, you know, what I actually do when I go to visit these wineries.
Go ahead.
That's kind of interesting. Not everybody is as lucky as to be able to have access to these people. I'm very, very aware of how lucky I am in that regard. And I'll quote a good friend in the wine business. I always describe this to one person, but he's told me that he may or may not actually have been the one who said it after the fact. So I'll leave it vague. But one person said to me early days of my career that they learned a great deal more standing next to a barrel than they ever did from a book. And I love that sentiment, and I couldn't agree more. And you know, this can kind of parlay into some of the other things we're going to talk about. But the biggest takeaway I hope people get when they ask me about education and how to increase their knowledge in wine and really get into it, especially if they're professionals, is you have to travel to the regions. You have to access the people who make the wine. You have to get comfortable with them and have them become comfortable with you. And then you have the opportunity to understand more about what they do. And that doesn't translate to, you know, people ask me if I take notes when I go to these tastings. I almost never do. If I'm going to a winery for the first time, I might write down a handful of notes just to keep my memory jogged, you know, what some of the techniques are, what their regimens are in terms of farming, et cetera. But for the most part, I try and engage in a conversation, and I'm genuinely interested in what they have to say, and I'm listening and paying attention, oftentimes listening intently and trying to translate it myself because my French isn't very good. And
not like Daniel's.
Daniel's fluent. I'm not. And frankly, he was a bit of a handicap to me for many years because I traveled with him. I never learned because he would translate for me.
I've since gotten
a little bit better. But what I take away from that is more important information than, for example, how much new oak people use or what the function of this additive might be or whether they add anything at all, you know, temperature, you know, yield, whole cluster or not. I do ask those questions because it's interesting, but it usually is interesting because it leads into a further conversation on their big picture ideas about what winemaking is. And that can be very informative in terms of the style of the wine that you're going to get, how those wines are going to evolve. Now, you know, you and I are both been drinking wine for a fairly good amount of time. And I'm about 20 years plus into the business, which means that the youngest vintage that I've ever tasted from the time it was in barrel to today is probably vintages from the early 2000s when I first started visiting wine. And, you know, we're drinking a 2003 Côte Rôtie. I didn't taste this in barrel. The first time I visited Clusel was much later. But if I had tasted it in barrel and I'm tasting it today, and I've tasted it a number of times throughout my career since then, having bought and sold many cases of it in all of the restaurants, it's still so young. 20 years is not really that long a time in the world of wine. So gaining this information from the winemakers, from the horse's mouth, so to speak, teaches me about what are they worried about? What are they thinking about when they made this wine? What are they thinking about the wine in retrospect? How did decisions that they made at that time affect the way they've made decisions in further vintages? And what do they think about all that now? You know, seeing the evolution of people's ideas around the wines that they make, if they make it, is very interesting. It's not unlike, I think, asking an artist what they're shooting for when they produce something in visual arts. But the beauty is it's actually comprehensible because it's pretty simple and technical. It isn't art, it's craft,
right,
to a great extent. So that's what I'm doing. what I'm asking them can vary immensely. You know, I was recently in a winery in Oregon, and I noticed that there was music playing. And I asked the winemaker, well, is there always music playing? He said, yeah, absolutely.
Is it for the vines?
No, this was in the cellar, in fact, and the wine was already in barrel. And he just said, you know, there's no way that the vibrations don't have an effect on the wine. So I just always play music. That teaches me about the way that the guy approaches everything from the, you know, it wasn't the season for farming. They were basically waiting for harvest at the time. But I from his inclinations about, you know, music in the cellar, there's a lot you can gain in terms of understanding the big picture.
He's thinking a little differently.
So that's a lot of where I'm going in terms of the kind of questions that I ask, in terms of understanding the holistic approach of what people are doing in the wineries.
Do you get a chance year in, year out to visit the same people?
Yes.
And you're talking to them about what we just discussed. And I would think year to year, it changes by vintage alone and the challenges of that.
Absolutely.
Or so, what else? Evolution, trying new things? Or
That's absolutely true, especially true in the Rhone and Burgundy, where year in and year out, if I'm going to the same producers, the biggest reason I'm doing that is because in our work as sommeliers, and you know, at this point, Daniel and I are more as consultants to restaurants and to private clients, it's super important for me to be up to speed with the wines, especially the hard to reach wines. You know, the top end producers in all of the regions, it's very rare to be able to taste the wines once they're finished before someone buys them. And so I have access to that. It's important for me to get a sense of them so I can advise the restaurants and the collectors on how to purchase, how to, you know, utilize their resources for their best gain. And also, it's not untrue of Champagne, but the fact is when I visit Champagne, I'm less tasting for the opportunity to understand what to buy, as I'm looking for a data point on the same wines when I'm going back over and over again, so I can see how the evolution works.
Why is that more important?
It's important in Burgundy also, but
it is. But so you're focusing more in Champagne.
I'm focusing on that in Champagne, but aside from that, Champagne is such a complex universe rather than a wine.
Explain a little why.
I will. I'll get into it. So, you know, Champagne might be the most complex enterprise in the wine business, in the wine world of all. And I always say Champagne truly represents the best value anyone can imagine in terms of just the energy and the human energy that goes into it.
What goes into it?
Right. So yeah. With the still wine from a place like Burgundy, you know, I was just there at the harvest. You get the sense that these vines were planted at a certain point, maybe 40, 50, 100 years ago. Farming has to happen every year for this to continue to produce. But then given that season, there's a certain amount of work in the vineyard throughout the season. There's the work of harvest, of, you know, destemming, crushing, pressing, barreling down, et cetera, until the wine goes into its, you know, quiet stage and goes through its evolution in barrel, gets bottled. You taste it a couple of times. It needs to age more in the bottle before it's drinkable. That sounds pretty complex. Now think about Champagne. When you have to do all of that, but in addition to that, you have to do it with very, very strict rules around the yield and the press, the quantity of how things are pressed is super important in Champagne.
These are pre-existing regulations or codes?
This is the law, exactly.
The law, right.
This is the law.
Of Champagne.
And then you have to see that evolution of the wine prior to the bottling. So be it in barrel or in tank, what have you. The bottling usually occurs early in the year after harvest, and sometimes a little bit later in the year after harvest, depending on the style. So there's additionally scores of decisions to be made there. Then you have a second fermentation, which still to this day boggles my mind to understand how it's such a precise process when it's so complex. You have the addition of yeast and sugar. You have the production of the CO2 in the bottle as the alcohol content goes up exactly the right amount or a very specific amount. You have the kind of closure that goes on top of this wine before it's completed. Then you have the finishing of the bottle, disgorgement, dosage or not, topping up the bottle, how to bring it to market. Champagne, in terms of the energy and work that goes into it, is so much more mind-boggling than anything else in the wine world. And when you think about it in those terms, and you look at a $60 to $65 bottle of champagne, not an inexpensive bottle of wine for anybody. I mean, it's a lot of money, $60. But if you're buying a non-vintage or a multi-vintage wine from a good producer, you know, usually you can find something in the $60 range. That represents tremendous value in my eyes for a delicious wine that's A, pretty much ready to drink, although it'll age very well. B, the amount of energy and work that has gone into it is so immense. And you compare that, for example, with $60 spent in Bordeaux, Napa Valley, Napa. Burgundy.
Overpriced.
Even the Rhone to some degree, although yeah. The Rhone is relatively inexpensive. You're not getting the same thing for $60. So it's almost like a steal in the wine world. And of course, as a sommelier and a relatively lazy one, I love champagne doubly because it pairs with everything.
So stay with that because, you know, you eloquently laid out that champagne, you know, it's a wine and then it goes through all these, you know, processes, you know, and it's very difficult. The problem that I've seen, and I've also seen a change, and I want you to talk, you know, about this, is it's been boxed as a celebratory wine. You know,
if it's lucky, it's been boxed as a celebratory wine. Often it's just right. like a celebration, but not so much wine now, at all.
But yeah. 80s, 90s, it was a club wine. Mm-hmm. I mean, certain bottles were like these status things. It didn't matter, you know, what you said, how it was made or the maker. It was just, you know, a cool thing. People don't think about it for food.
Yeah, champagne is broken out of that. You asked a question earlier, specific to Burgundy, about, you know, young or new producers and the change of generation. Although I can't speak much to the change of generation that I've seen in champagne, because most of the producers that I work with, where there are generational businesses, have been at the helm for a little while. And I would say their predecessing generation, their focus was on producing the best thing that they could sell.
So now you're going to shift me into the grower movement.
We're speaking of both new growers
guy
and houses.
A family yeah. guy that made it for someone else well, and
is,
now decided
this is
to-
as true for a grower or for a house. But in the past, be it growers who are trying to produce something they could sell to houses or sell at the market, houses trying to produce something that they could sell in the market, obviously, to today, having a fairly easy time bringing things to market. I think that the world of champagne has been accepted, especially in the big markets of the US and the Far East, as a serious wine.
Hmm? A lot of cheerleaders, you know, sommeliers,
restaurants. A lot of cheerleaders, I count myself amongst them.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Daniel isn't here to take credit for it, but I'll give it to him anyway. Him and Peter had this idea to put together a festival that really brought the whole world of champagne together for the very first time. You know, the distinction you just drew between growers and houses is not unimportant in terms of the way the structure of the business is and the world of champagne, but it is unimportant in terms of the quality of the wine. There isn't a side to be picked that growers are better than houses or vice versa. That's pure nonsense. There's amazing wine being made from both structures, if you will, and they both need each other.
But there are people that do pick sides, which based on how you're presenting it to me is a little crazy, because the quality, don't think if it's not a grower, the quality
I'm not inclined
not there,
to call those
opposite.
People who have a strong preference crazy. I just say that they are choosing something relatively that I believe is arbitrary in order to decide who's in and who's out.
I agree.
And the La Fête du Champagne's approach has always been the opposite of that, which is here is the world of champagne in its entirety for you to see, for you to taste and to enjoy and to experience. And today, if someone's really specifically anti-house, that's hilarious to me, because all of the top growers that we feature, nearly all of them have some amount of fruit that they're purchasing, or some Negocion business that they have added on, simply because as growers, they weren't able to buy more enough land or much more land. So they've had to be able to buy grapes in order to produce more wine. There's certainly, as we said, a market for it today.
Right.
You know, producers like Raphael Beresh has a Negocion line of wines and a Domaine line of wines.
So
and good, continues to grow, and the wines are all great.
Good segue. You know, help me with this, because always when I have somebody like you, so I guess Beresh checks that box. If people are looking for interesting and quality champagnes, but are looking for the value, I mean, are there certain things they're going to look for? Non-vintage, maybe more. I mean, where do we go? And then bring me to a producer or two. Like I said, we'll put Beresh up there. He's making great quality to value in that range.
Spectacular. And he's spectacular. He's a dear friend. I'm a big fan. I recognize that, but I loved the wines before I got to love the person even. Okay, well, if you want to have an approach to finding value, number one is taste as much wine as possible, because very often, just because it's not expensive doesn't mean it's not good. And the inverse is definitely true. Just because it's expensive doesn't mean that it is good. Don't ignore small houses, because oftentimes their non-vintage wine, because of the structure of their business, is able to offer pretty interesting complexity on account of a lot of reserve wine, which brings, you know, roundness, complexity, texture, whereas it's harder for either a grower, especially a young grower, young company, to produce something with that same mouthfeel, that same
right. sort
of character of aged champagne. And that, and here I'm speaking of the non-vintage, you know,
right.
call it the main bottling or the cheapest bottling. That's one thing to pay attention to and approach.
What's a good example? Amongst
producers, I think, or growers that that work specific to certain terroir, you should learn about what you like. You know, there's Champagne's a big region. When wine is being made in a very small part of Champagne, it's still Champagne, but it has something that's unique in terms of expression. So if you get to know certain growers who make wine in specific villages and you know that you like them, look for other growers in that village.
So stylistically.
Yeah, well,
but hunt for style, hunt for region.
That's yeah, exactly.
What about varietal? I mean, you know, there's Blanc de Blanc, which people don't even know. That's just an all, you know, Chardonnay. There's Pinot Meunier, Pinot Noir. I mean,
my table for each of those styles of wine. When it comes to the grape variety, I think most people don't really pay as much attention to what the variety is and more to names like Blanc de Blanc in terms of style, and that's okay. If they know it's all Chardonnay, that's great. But, you know, that's not the most important thing. What's right. important is that
they're... That was my point.
My point is more pay attention to what you like, take note of it, and seek out things that that fit in the same category, because then you'll be able to expand your world of what you're tasting, and you'll find value, for sure.
I know you're going to agree with this, but if you're in a restaurant that you know is good or you like, or you have a local wine store that's more than a commodity store, beer and ice, that if you tell those people what you like,
trust your friendly experts.
At least some good tries, right?
Yeah, trust your friendly experts. You know, make friends with your friendly local sommelier and your caviste, and you'll get great advice from them for sure. And don't be afraid to try something new.
Yeah. Try.
Exactly.
Which is a great
thing. It's rare for me to walk into a shop and if I see a champagne I've never seen before, it's very rare for me to walk out of the shop without that bottle, because I want to taste as much as possible.
I'm embarrassed when I go into a restaurant that's a decent restaurant, whether I know the wine person or not, and totally defer to them. I mean, them have worked so hard to put a list together, whatever the lean is, you know, whether it's German wines or Burgundy or Bordeaux, it's like you're doing some good stuff there. So what should I drink? I mean, I thought I knew a lot in the early days where I'd say, oh, I want this or that. That would embarrass me now. So, you know, lean on that.
I think that's a healthy approach.
Yeah. And I think you net better results.
And again, this comes back to education. You know, the consumer has to educate themselves. The professionals have to be educated
But you have to be inquisitive and you want to, and you're going to have to try things and you'll stumble on some stuff. But boy, when you hit it, you know, you're drinking some good stuff. All right. thanks for some good intel on Champagne and Burgundy. When we talk about La Table a little, you know, we could talk about a couple of Rhone wines and follow up on the Cote Rôti. All right, so let's get into the wine festivals. I think you spend a lot of time on these.
I do.
Getting there, doing them.
When I say you, I mean everyone. You introduce them, but let me clarify the four sort of, shall we call them, platforms that you mentioned. So La Fête du Champagne, which launches today, is our champagne festival, celebration of the entire region, founded by Peter Liam, who's the world's foremost champagne expert, and a dear friend, and Daniel Thomas. And so next year we'll celebrate the 10th anniversary of La Fête du Champagne, which is very exciting. I mean, all of them are exciting. And it's really grown from being, you know, a bit of a niche festival where we had to convince people that champagne was a serious wine to some degree, to something that...
Well, that was, we discussed that before. It was either celebratory or in the back. Now it's very exciting to most people.
The festival really has legs. It has a huge audience, a very excited audience. We launched sales, I forget if it was August or early September, and effectively sold out the entire New York festival in a matter of 2 to 3 days, which was spectacular and very exciting. The same thing happened last year, and we were in Los Angeles for the festival. So it was a, you know, relatively new market for us. And that's very heartening because it means that it's working. And one of the other things I absolutely love about La Fête is the way that it really brings the region together and brings it forward in a unified sense. There were several, you know, leaders of houses that when they first would come to La Fête, they wouldn't shake a grower's hand, and now they vacation with them. So things have changed over the years, and everyone gets along. Everyone has a great time. No, of course, I'm not going to tell you who.
I didn't ask.
La Table, which is coming up at the end of November, beginning of December, is our Rhone festival. So this is a festival that Daniel first launched in 2019. So it's a relatively young festival for us. It's still finding its legs to some degree, but has continued to grow and is a lot of fun. The producers from the Rhone Valley, I think, really appreciate a spotlight being shown upon them. And we're excited about them too, because I think that, you know, similar to Champagne in terms of the quality of the wines, and similar to Burgundy in terms of the structure of the small producers and tiny holdings, there's a lot of character, there's a lot of history, there's a lot of terroir to be spoken about in both the North and South. And I love to be able to talk about them and bring them to the forefront. They're incredible food wines. They're especially great, you know, as we get
totally
into the colder
different
months,
varietally wines, than yeah, Burgundy, you exactly know, just the whole, you know.
Yes, but there's some similitude in culture, which is why it makes sense.
I didn't
for
say
us to
culture.
Work.
Yeah. I've,
no,
but
yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes,
the wines
yes,
are
yes
different. And that's why it works. So we're excited about that. That will launch, as I said, next month, at the end of next month and the beginning
so
of December.
For La Table, nothing's on sale yet, right?
Everything's on sale.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
the website is up with
yes,
the
sir
current
and
schedule.
I'll run through all of the websites. Okay. I'm sure you can put them also on your site afterwards. La Palais was the original festival that Daniel started. Next year will be, not next year, excuse me, in 2025 will be the 25th anniversary.
Wow.
Which is very exciting.
That is exciting.
And obviously this is the festival that kind of built the structure for all the rest of them and also built a great deal of the following that Daniel's enjoyed over the years. Burgundy is the focus there. No kidding. And I think that it's, at this point, it kind of speaks for itself that many people who come to the Grand Tasting say to me afterwards, they're like, this is the greatest tasting of, that you could possibly have in the U.S. just because you have the producers that are really hard to get to. I mean, you know, the Rhone is maybe the proprietors are a little less known. Champagne, they're perhaps a little more visible. In Burgundy, they're a little harder to get to because they make very little wine and they're right, very high in demand. So I know that a lot of people really, really love that tasting. And you've been there a few times, and I know you're a fan as well. So
it's just, you know, a couple things. Answer this one quickly. Daniel was inspired when he was in Europe by like a Hospice de Beaune thing or something, or something else?
It wasn't the Hospice de Beaune. It's actually called La Palais. So
right, which is La more Palais of a gathering.
Is a every domain has what they call their Palais at the end of harvest, which is really a harvest celebration. In November, in Merceau, in the village of Merceau, there's a larger party La Palais de Meursault, which is actually, it's in like 3 weeks, the week of Thanksgiving this year. And so that was founded and sort of kicked off by the Lafon family back in the 20s.
Wow.
And today, you know, it's a luncheon on a Monday where producers from the village, wine growers, winemakers, merchants, all get invited. They invite their friends. They bring bottles from their cellar and everyone shares with each other. Our event for La Palais, which is, you know, modeled after that, but encompasses all of Burgundy, not just the village of
Meursault,
is intentionally a place for sharing. And, you know, it's a big BYO dinner. We have great chefs, which they don't always have in Meursault. Usually the food is a little bit more rudimentary there at the day of the Palais. And producers from all over Burgundy who bring wines from their cellars, and collectors from all over the U.S. and around the world who bring wines from their cellars, and everyone shares and has a grand old time. So that's a big part of our ethos, is bringing together not just an educational opportunity for consumers via the tastings or these very special moments with the small dinners that we do specific to certain domains, but also to have this sort of opportunity to have the winemakers and the collectors and consumers, you know, enjoy wine together.
So
last thing I want to talk about is pressoir. There's a little bit of confusion around what pressoir is. Pressoir is effectively everything we do which isn't a wine festival. So we have programming that's ongoing throughout the year. We do small tastings. We call them apéro. We sometimes do small seminar-style classes. We do quite a few small dinners, and we really love that intimate setting where we actually rent out private spaces and restaurants in order to do this. So we work with a lot of the top chefs in town, and we love to bring the business to them as well, where we'll do wines on a theme very often, where we've sourced the wines directly from the domains. And that's true for champagnes, burgundies, rhones. We've done a few Piedmont dinners. We've done stuff with wines from regional France, Loire. So a bit of a wider palette there. Pressoir is also
year-round.
Year-round, exactly. Exactly that, right. And we also use that platform to house all of our consulting activities. So we consult for a series of restaurant groups, helping them fine-tune their business from a wine perspective. And hopefully increase their business from a wine perspective. And we also do some consulting work, a little bit of, on the corporate side, and some personal consulting to help people build their cellars and things like that. So that's what pressoir is.
Does the... there's education in that. Let's talk about cause. I mean, you do scholarships and stuff. Is that through individual events or through pressoir or a little
bit? So that is actually a separate entity now. So a little background on the Sommelier Scholarship Fund, which Daniel, it was Daniel's idea. And when he started this initiative, really, it was supported by producers in Burgundy first, only Burgundy, where the wines would be donated or sold by domains via auction, via our auction partner. And proceeds from that would, you know, partially go to the domain and partially go to fund a trip to Burgundy for wine professionals who have never had that opportunity. The reason for that was that Daniel was starting to worry that because as the prices of the wines, especially the top wines, began to escalate, you know, starting around 04, but really like by the end of the aughts and the teens, many wines were well outside of the reach of many wine professionals, even in their businesses. So they never got to taste the wines at tastings. But then the kind of restaurants they worked in, it just didn't make sense to buy and sell them. You know, a village Meursault used to be attainable for $30-$40 wholesale. You could sell it for $80 to $90 or $100, whatever your markup needed to be. That became obsolete. Now village wines cost $100+ a wholesale often. And so he was really worried that the region was going to fall out of the grasp of the young wine professionals in the next generation. And really thought of this as an opportunity to, once again, bring people as a learning opportunity to the barrels rather than the books, to connect with the people, to understand the cuisine, understand the culture and the place. And it's really where you learn everything, I think. So this progressed. We started doing a champagne scholarship as well, with producers, again, supporting it back then. And this was not formal at all. It wasn't a nonprofit in any formal sense. It was a nonprofit activity that Daniel just did. Exactly. Yeah. In 2021, the end of 2021, we formalized a 501c3. And so now the Sommelier Scholarship Fund is its own entity, and it's separate from our for-profit businesses, which I described earlier. It is completely staffed by volunteers from our company. So we have almost no overhead. We pay for a little bit of wine storage, and we have to pay someone to do the taxes and keep the books. But other than that, we have almost no expenses.
Deal.
Yeah. I'm a strong believer in efficient charities. Nothing irritates me more than, a charity that has to raise $1 million to give $100,000. And I understand why some of that has to be the case.
$200,000 CEO running it or something.
They do good work. They deserve to get paid. For us, this isn't
different
a full-time
approach.
This isn't a full-time activity for us either. Right. This is something we're able to put enough time and energy into. And more importantly, now that it's an official charity, we're able to raise funds from outside of the producers, because we already ask a lot of producers in terms of their time, in terms of access to wine, access for people to visit them, et cetera, et cetera. So giving this opportunity to the American public to support and with the tax deduction was very smart, I think, on Daniel's part. And it's been a great success. It's in, I think, anybody who loves wine and goes to restaurants and goes to a cavis to ask for information about wine or likes somebody else's opinion totally should support this kind of an initiative, because while it seems maybe from the outside frivolous potentially, what people need to understand is that without having this sort of immersive experience with the producers, all wine professionals are basically brokers. And maybe they're passionate brokers, but they're not connected to the place and they're not connected to the people who produce it. When they are, their initiatives, their purpose, their sense of purpose changes substantially. I've seen it many times. I've been working with Daniel on that initiative long before it became the Sommelier Scholarship Fund. And he involved me in the selection of the scholars from the outset. And I'm very passionate about it. I really believe it's a wonderful opportunity for people to learn. And so those people who are listening to your show, if you're in the wine business, you should absolutely apply
sommelierscholarship.org. So where? I mean, we're going to go through all the websites and everything. There's a lot. But for this specifically, because we're talking about it, if somebody says, why not? Where do I reach out? Where do they?
Sommelier Scholarship Fund is easily Googleable. It's sommelierscholarship.org.
Okay, so it has its own Sommelier Scholarship.
The best place to go to find everything, just because La Palais is the easiest name to remember, go to lapalais.com. And everything else we do is linked in the top banner. That's probably the easiest way to find us.
All right. Before we wrap up, you talked about all the festivals, and I think everyone has a pretty good feel. What I want to talk about for a couple of minutes is sort of the mechanics, and there's a similarity. Like, I'll set it up for you. All the events have a grand tasting. All the events have some kind of, educational masterclass. There's some very reasonable lunches and dinners and some expensive ones. Tell me about the common things, that when you go on the website, we didn't do justice. I mean, we talked about the tasting and the gala dinner. There's a lot going on during the week. Just check off everything for me.
Sure. So why don't we talk about Table, because by the time this goes to air, I already have a few people.
But Table's formula follows in a way.
It's very similar. We're trying something a little bit different this year, because after all, the region isn't the same and the feeling doesn't have to be the same. But we're going to do a series of small dinners and lunches during La Table. We're doing one dinner, which is not a collaboration with a producer, because sadly said producer has passed. But we acquired a selection of wines from Manny Burke of the Rare Wine Company's collection. And he's going to attend. And he's very passionate about these wines from Noël Verse from Cornas. So that'll be it's a very fancy occasion and not an inexpensive dinner. But these wines are very rare now. And the sourcing
super is unique and rare.
Super special. Yeah.
And it's kind of if you know, you know type thing.
It is. But at the same time, thanks to Manny's largesse to a great extent, because he's working with us to keep the price very fair, although not inexpensive. If you take any of the two older vintages that are in the tasting, you couldn't buy a single bottle of that wine for the price of the dinner, and you'll get to taste, you know, 14 vintages.
Cool.
And listen to Manny talk about them, which is maybe worth
the price
of the entry.
Thematically, lunches.
Yeah.
You have the dinners.
Well, I'd like to talk about a couple of other ones during the tablet because I think they're illustrative. So we'll usually have something quite special like that. Maybe one or two, maybe just one. We'll usually have something that brings everyone to the table in a bit more old-fashioned sense. So during the tablet, that's the machon. The machon is sort of a lunchtime celebration, very rustic food. Daniel Boulud cooks for this event, and he loves cooking for it because it really takes him back home to Lyon. A large pot of stew is sort of the centerpiece.
More rustic.
We have a handful
fancy.
Of producers, up and comers, not necessarily the fanciest appellations, but really good, honest wines that are not very expensive. And it isn't a formal wine dinner where you get, you know, three wines per course. The producers will be there. The bottles will be on the table. People get to pitch in and have a glass. It's a really like fun time, not expensive, and approaching wine in truly a Lyonnaise fashion, which is important because that's sort of the seat of the region in the north. But I think you see how the spirit of the cuisine of Lyon really connects with the Rhone Valley. So that gives you a couple of examples. We often do a tasting of off-grid for the Palais, which I think is, it makes sense for the Palais, obviously not for the Tablet, for example, but where we talked about, you know, featuring or highlighting the sort of less known
right.
appellations and producers. And then we usually have a tasting of the current vintage. So that's what you described as the Grand Tasting, which is the name we use for the Palais and for Lafette, but the concept is the same. Producers bring 3 to 4 wines of their current offerings, and the producer will be behind the table along with an excellent sommelier. The function of that is that the sommelier does the pouring while the producer gets to do the talking.
Right.
And
done well that way.
And so our clients get to really interact with the producer, get to have a bit more intimate knowledge and get to know them a little bit and see their current range. And we have some amazing culinary aspects there too, always in the tastings. We bring in local restaurants. We have a handful of partners that bring, you know, oysters from the West Coast or caviar for the champagne event.
It's pretty impressive.
It's a lot of fun.
It's well curated.
And
every one of them.
And we work very hard to get new restaurants, not necessarily new businesses, but, you know.
I was going to say, it's not the same.
It's not static.
Exactly. You know, fancy guy. It's Daniel Boulud's always there, but
we
try
and
make
sure
like
it,
a
yeah.
Daniel Eddy or a James O'Brien who've been on the scene for years doing good stuff.
Indeed. Hopefully, we'll see who listens to this and see how many angry texts I get from different chefs. But this year, if you
those
come
are
to
just examples, we're
if
not
you come
playing
to the
tablet
tasting
leave
this
Raj
year.
Alone. You have a problem, you come to me. All
well,
right.
Well, if you come to the tablet tasting this year, you might get to taste dueling terrines from two different chefs named Daniel. I'm just saying.
I like that. That's a good one.
And then we have a celebratory dinner or lunch. So this year, the tablet will be a lunch. We thought it would be more fun to do the grand tasting in the evening and have it be a bit more of a fun atmosphere. So it'll
so
actually
flip-flop
be in Brooklyn.
From
we'll flip-flop them, exactly.
Cool.
They won't be on the same day. The tasting will be in the evening on the Friday night. And then Saturday, we're going to have our gala during the daytime. We're actually going to do it in Manhattan. So you can imagine a bunch of these country bumpkins from the Rhone.
The view.
They're going to get a heck of a view out of it. We're talking about the Rhone. We've talked about... the next generation. We've talked about organic farming. We've talked about, you know, Daniel's
climate
history in wine. Can we talk about this wine?
Yeah.
Because this wine encapsulates
all of those.
So
we're going to flip-flop things. I do a thing called the wine list where I ask you 5 questions. We're going to do that. And I also do, I end the show with the wine sip, the weekly
right.
wine sip, where we taste, evaluate, and discuss a wine, which is what we're going to do here. Because I said, bring something that is... you know, a reference to what you're doing. And this is a Rhone wine. And like you said, as we're talking, people still may hear this, go to the website for champagne, La Fête du Chien, and there may be one or two things they could still get into. I could tell you right now, it's tight. but La Table is coming up. So this wine, this is a great example. So every week we taste a different wine on air. Tell me specifically about this wine. The producer, vintage year, why you brought it.
So as Daniel said earlier in the show, he started importing Clouzel right when they began. And so I've always known the wines because Daniel imported them. And the back label on this Magnum says Daniel Jonas Selection from back when he was importing the wines. This is early 2000s. It was for a long time the only practicing and certified organic producer in Côte Rôtie. Côte Rôtie is not known for its history of organic farming, quite the opposite. The reason for that, the primary reason for that is that it's so hard to work. It's very, very steep. And so weeding is extremely difficult. Animals are not really easy to use or control. And so most people just use herbicides in order to,
take care of things.
This was not the approach from the Clouzel. The Clouzel have had a closer connection to what they're putting into the land because they are truly farmers and they definitely consume a lot of their wine. And they just didn't like the feel of it. So they never used chemicals, which is kind of great because their land is extremely well maintained. Talking about the next generation, so not this past spring, but the one prior, Daniel and I attended the party that the Clouzel threw for the retirement of Guillaume and Brigitte. The previous generation. Guillaume's the son, sorry. And he was officially taking over. Now, mind you, Guillaume's been making the wine for quite some time. And the Tuesday after this party, which was on a Saturday, we went back to the winery to taste. And Brigitte, who had just retired, was sitting at a table and doing, tea grafting for their own nursery. So it was just an occasion for a party, but it kind of gives you the sense of how important it is for a family business like that to continue with the next generation. 03 is it's a tricky vintage for me in the Northern Rhone because there's some really lovely wines and there's some really inky and heavy wines. It really is a question of when they were picked and how the wines were made. I never disliked Clouzel's 03s, but I also didn't love the vintage in general at the time. I've come to realize that actually the best wines just needed time, as you can see from this bottle. This is a Magnum, so it still has some tannic character, but we've been now tasting it over the course of about an hour, and it's slowly opened up. The tannins are much softer than they were before. I double decanted it around 11 a.m. and now it's 1:30. It's starting to drink pretty well. Yeah. I'll be finishing it with our team after our first event for Lafette. So hopefully it'll be really wide.
I took another taste.
Yeah, for sure. I'll make sure of that. So 100% Syrah in this case, of course. I just think that these wines show tremendous elegance while still being a tremendous value. Côte Rôtie is a pretty fancy appellation, but compared with Burgundy, it's still, for great wine, you're not paying up that much. Clouzel, for whatever reason, possibly because they're not a tiny producer, but also I think just because they weren't on everybody's radar, have never really reached the soaring heights of the Gigal wines or even Jamet, for example, in the secondary market. So you can still buy a current vintage of these wines.
That's a good thing.
For a very reasonable price, I think. And the wines are truly exceptional. It's one of my favorite domains.
So that's the 2003 Clouzel Côte Rôtie. What's the designation?
Le Grand Place. It's their one of their biggest parcels, which is on the top of the crown of the hill in Côte Rôtie.
So nice. I'm not going to get into the 03, but if I was looking at current vintages, better places would have Clouzel Roque.
Yes, yes. Of course, not in huge quantities, so they tend to come and
what
go.
What would a 750? I mean, what range are we looking at?
For retail? Grand Place, that's a good question. I think it's probably about $100.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit more.
Okay. But a great value, for that. And that's the Northern Rhone.
That's correct.
And I didn't mention this, but I post all the info we talked about on our social media websites. So it sort of has all the aspects of a Côte Rôtie, but a warm vintage, tannic. Anything they're doing that differentiates them from other?
I think because of the organic farming,
maybe more lively
they have the benefit probably of having the wine be a little less heavy despite the vintage. The problem with 03 was not just that it was hot, but that it was so hot that the vegetal processes of the vine shut down eventually. So they stopped producing sugar and just went dormant because they were overheated. When you have organic farming at this level and cover crops, you also have better water retention, despite the high elevation. And I think that they probably, although it's hard to believe that they didn't have some hydric stress, the vines probably managed it better because of the organic farming. So I don't find the thing I dislike in some O3s, which is a inky sort of syrupy character. And I also don't find the other extreme that comes with that, which is, you know, those characters come from the alcohol or the potential alcohol from the heat of the vintage. But alongside that, oftentimes O3s have this like vegetal green note from like, both overripeness like and sugar,
green
but underripeness
peppery
and,
or stem.
Yeah, it's a phenolic issue.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting in the right way, but you're saying it's too much over the top.
Sometimes it can be. Here, I don't feel like that's a problem at all. They also use whole cluster. Clouzel has always been a whole cluster house, and so that provides, I think, a little bit additional freshness to the palate.
Are, you know, you said earlier that producers are not farming that responsibly because of the region, you know, using
Côte Rôtie historically, yeah.
Is that changing or
yes,
it's still
very much so.
Stuck?
No, it's very much
little
changing.
Little by little. So that's promising.
I think a big part of that is a generational change, but also yeah. I think for a quality level of wine at a certain point, you know, Champagne still, it's a amazingly small amount of the vineyard area in Champagne is organic.
I know.
But it's growing and growing exponentially. And I think the same thing is definitely true in the Rhône. Especially in Côte Rôtie, we're seeing, you know, more people farming organically, even if they haven't been certified. I'd pull out and focus on
practice and certification are two different things. You could be practicing and doing a fine job.
What's important is what people are doing.
That's more of what I'm saying. All right. Before we leave, I want to just run the wine list by you. Don't dwell on these answers. Five questions. You've answered them before.
I feel like I've done this several times. So
you may have done it a few times. All right. First question always is, what are you drinking now? So what's in the fridge? What are you experimenting with? Does it tie into the festivals? Does it tie into seasonality? Could be beer.
I don't drink as much beer anymore. As I've gotten older, that's become harder.
So what are you drinking now?
So right now I'm drinking a lot of champagne, but that's always true. That's not really a seasonally
that's
specific
a thing
answer.
Now you enjoy it and you'll always drink
I always have been a big champagne drinker, by volume. Champagne, I drink much more than I do any other wine, I'd say. I've been really kind of excited by, what this change of season, although it's warmer today and will be for the next few days, the beginning of autumn, I quite like, dipping back into, you know, orange wines with a bit of skin contact, so that salinity and texture, and pretty wide ranging in my approach there in terms of regionality. I am not quite at the point where
Italy, France, Eastern Europe. I mean, they're all
A lot of French, a lot more French than others, but certainly even Germany. I haven't quite gotten to the Rhône part of the year yet. It's really when
Like
after daylight savings is when I'm like, it's Syrah time. But for sure, I've been drinking a couple of different Saint-Joseph meals of late. And, you know, whenever I get the chance to drink Burgundy, I do. But more often professionally than personally.
Those are all good ones. You know, I have a cellar, so whenever I go out to dinner with friends, I won't let them bring wine because why would I drink their crap wine? So I said, don't bring anything, I'll bring it. So I would always bring a white and a red, a couple of reds.
Yeah.
I do not go out to eat without bringing a bottle of champagne instead of the white, sometimes a white. People go, why'd you bring that? And you know, what we discussed, celebratory.
It's a real wine. It's because you're a lazy sommelier.
Restaurants, they're opening with seafood salad. Yeah, yeah. It goes well with that stuff, except maybe with the exception of a steakhouse. Plenty of stuff for it to go in.
Well, next week in Houston, we're going to do a Salon and Delamotte dinner at Papa's Steakhouse in Houston,
it's
Texas.
Famous.
Which
is what's his name still down there? Jack?
No. Steve McDonald.
Steve. Okay. All right. Let's move to the next question. Kind of falls into what we're talking about. Goofiest question on the list. Maybe it's the same as last time. Maybe not. Favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think is a good one. What you like.
Right now, I'm really excited by Côte Rôtie and, you know, salami pizza, what we just had.
Okay. We're at Roberta's. We had a bee sting, which is basically a margarita with a wide cut supersod, which is the spicy supersod.
Spicy supersod and honey.
And honey, but hot honey.
Yeah, that's right.
So you have the heat of the honey, the spice, and that wine goes perfectly.
So this O3 Côte Rôtie was really good with it, the vegetal touch.
We kind of nailed it at lunch, right?
Yeah, we did all right.
All right, so... You mentioned this a couple of minutes ago and tell me your comfort level here. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Now, let me set it up and then I'll guide you through this. What places are doing it well? What places are you comfortable with? What places kind of get it, have the vibe, the selection? And everyone may vary. This place may be good for just French wines, whatever. Answer that if you want. If you feel to answer that, that you'll be exclusive and like you said, you'll get some calls, don't answer it. Are you comfortable? And these are not your favorites.
I'm super comfortable.
These are not in rank. give me places that you walk
I'm going to give
in.
You four restaurants, two Go. Of them in New York and two of them in Burgundy. How
Perfect.
About that? So let's start in New York. My hands down favorite restaurant is the Four Horsemen. It's very, I know everybody knows about it.
Not an uncommon answer on this show.
Not an uncommon answer.
Well deserved.
But I think it's important. I think two things are important. One is that there's very rarely a restaurant in New York City that can honestly say that they have what I describe as a real cellar, i.e. not a collection of wine they just bought 6 months ago or 2 years ago, but that I was lucky to be able to produce a great program out of a similar cellar at Restaurant Danielle. That's certainly true at the Four Horsemen. The other thing that's important pointing out about that restaurant is that it isn't a wine bar, regardless of what it began as or what it intended to be. It is a restaurant. The chef, Nick, is unbelievably talented chef and one of my favorite in the world. I always have an amazing meal there. I can't speak more highly of it. A less called out restaurant, I think, which I just had lunch there over the weekend, and I'm a really big fan. It's very much a neighborhood feel, the restaurant. It has wonderful acoustics. You can have a nice, loud neighborhood restaurant feel while still being able to hear each other. It becomes more and more important as I get older and older. Has a fantastic wine list, not a giant wine list, but
well
a small collection, super well thought out, and has something for, you know, the very wealthy collectors I sometimes dine with, and for me and my girlfriend when we're going for a Sunday lunch. Great champagne list, and that is Anton's in the West Village.
Natalie
is amazing. I don't think she's been spending too much time at the restaurant of late because Natalie and Nick just had their first child,
right?
Who I get to see in the neighborhood. We live in the same neighborhood, so I see them around from time to time. But nothing is lost by her temporary absence in that their staff is truly very personable and very warm. The food is delicious, and it's a restaurant that feels good. Every time I leave there, I feel great. So those are my two New York answers.
I'm a fan of Nick's food, Natalie. I met her at Dan Kluger's place. She was at Loring Place for a few
years. I met her, I think, at Marta, which was right before
she
went to.
She's a sweetheart.
And so I'll drop it down to one. How about one restaurant in France that's worth mentioning because it's the one place I always go to, at least for lunch, is La Dilettante. If you have the opportunity to visit Beaune, you have to go to Dilettante. The cuisine has a bit of a Japanese bent to it. It's always a very small menu, but very, very well situated. The products are absolutely spectacular. They make a karaage, you know, a fried chicken. And I'm notorious for looking for Asian food when I'm in France. I love that. They usually only serve it at night. One time I made, I changed my whole travel plan so I could be there at night to have the fried chicken. And they didn't have it on the menu. I spoke to Lolo, the proprietor, and I was like, you don't have the fried chicken. He said, yeah, well, my chicken guy's on vacation and nobody else's chicken is good enough. So, it just gives
very
you a sense
discerning.
Of their approach to sourcing. But you can always drink super well from super natty, like hard to find bottles that are, you know, very sought after in New York and cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars for 60 to 80 euro there.
Wow.
Or you can drink, you know, Dovisat or Meunier for
reasonable.
Super fair prices. Delicious food, wonderful feeling, and maybe the best salad in all of France.
Does Beaune have a bunch of good restaurants or?
Oh yeah, there's
a good
lot of
restaurant town.
There. Absolutely, it's a great restaurant town.
I forgot. I don't know where it was. Like Champagne or Bordeaux is not a great restaurant town, or it's gotten better. Well,
there's good restaurants in France. The rest of the Champagne region it can be a little bit spotty.
Okay, so that's once you get out of
Peter Liam likes to joke that the only good restaurant in Epernay is called Hira. Hira is a North Indian restaurant where we often go for chana masala and tikka.
I think I'm asking that because I think I heard Peter tell me that years ago and it's stuck. You know, he kind of rolled his eyes when, you know, we got to this. But it's good to hear that. All right. We asked Daniel this before he left. So I'm going to ask you the same question. Favorite all-time wine, not the rarest, most expensive wine you ever drank. But, you know, you've been at this a long time. You've been exposed to a lot of good things. Look back like I said, it could have been 6 months ago or when you were 16. What was that wine that really made that, or wine or two, if it...
That's becoming increasingly hard to answer because, of course, I'm very lucky. I get to taste a lot of wine, and I also get to taste a lot of great wine. I'll pull out two different wines for two very different reasons. One of them is that kind of super fancy bottle because I had it recently. But it is fancy, but it's also peculiar in that it's not a vintage anybody really knows about. I was lucky to serve wine recently at a dinner where a bunch of very well-known Burgundian winemakers were in attendance from the absolute creme de la creme top domains. And a bottle of 1940 Comte de Vogüé Musigny was opened. And I've had a little experience tasting a couple of different 1940s, but like two. at the table, the claim was that none of them have ever tasted a 1940, although after the fact, I questioned that of a couple of them. I think they just either forgot or played along. But it's not a vintage that people know very much about. Number one is it was probably made mostly by ladies who were still at the domain. This is, you know, the height of the war and
that's interesting.
A difficult time, to say the very, very least, in Burgundy and in France in general. And in addition to that, it was a vintage that really isn't written about, probably also because of the time that
not
it occurred, but also
vintage.
Because there wasn't really a market and people weren't buying these wines very robustly after them. So the bottle was in unbelievable condition and it really boggled my mind. I think about it. I had it like 2.5 weeks ago. I've woken up every morning thinking about that bottle.
Wow.
So there is a place for old wine when it's in great condition. It can be really moving and it can really make an impression on me. A wine that is sort of the other side of that, a totally different approach that I really love. I have been going back and forth with a buddy of mine because he's a friend who's in the wine business, has been on the show before, but he tends to get very excited about wines that he really likes. And then if he has something that he doesn't like, he's quick to text me, especially if he knows I'm a fan, and kind of like give me a hard time about it. So sometimes producers who make great wine, not every bottle of theirs is fantastic, right? It happens. This year in the summer, I took my girlfriend to, we were in Beaujolais and we went to visit Jean-Louis Dutreuve. And it's funny, one of the wines he poured for us amongst the 21s was a wine that had the flaw of mousiness. You know, it's a bacterial thing. And I in a very friendly way, he's a good friend and he's a sweet, sweet guy. I brought it up in conversation. I was like, maybe this has a little bit of what they call the gutsuri, the taste of mouse. And he said, yeah, probably. I can't really taste that. I don't really have like a attunement to it. So it's possible. And I was like, okay, well, that kind of informs me as to why sometimes some bottles are mousy from the domain. This friend of mine called me up and told me how much he hated the 2021 Domaine de la Grand Cru from Dutreuve. But that's my wine that I'm talking about today because 21's an interesting vintage. It's kind of like a little bit of a thinner vintage in terms of density in Beaujolais. After a series of very dense vintages, 17, 18, 19, and 20, where 19 has got tremendous balance, but the other three can be a little awkward. They can show more elbows than you know one necessarily likes, and also a little more alcohol, which Gamay is really delightful when it's fresh. It's a little less delightful when it
is
gets
it
heavy.
One of the crus or a village?
This was the old vine cuvee from the Grand Cru. Yeah, from the Clos. So my friend was saying that he had an experience of it as being mousy, which this wasn't the wine that was tasted mousy when I tasted them. And so I have a few bottles of that at home. I've had great experiences with it prior, so I decided I would try it again. And I opened it. It was one of those rare occasions. I was entirely by myself. I'd taken the night off of work, you know, obligations. I didn't
still
have to
still drink
have any
a wine when
dinners.
You're alone and have no plan.
My girlfriend was busy being healthy. She went for a run instead and ate a salad. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to drink a bottle of Beaujolais by myself. This bottle of wine was gone in like 40 minutes.
It was so glowable.
By myself. It was so delicious. There was no evidence of mouse. I'm not doubting my friend who tasted that, but it just like imprinted in my head that, you know, people can get hung up on specific things, but if they can just taste outside of that and just give it some time to evolve, maybe it would have blown off. I don't know. What was really imprinting itself in my mind the entire time I was drinking it was how it ran the gamut of, while having this delicacy and this lightness, it still had this juiciness, this juicy fruit that sat on top of that very light palate.
Beaujolais and Gamay should have a little of that juiciness.
I absolutely love it. I didn't mention that when I was saying what I'm drinking now, because I haven't been drinking as much Gamay as
like
I probably should.
Well, like I said, I'm going to post that. And, you know, people get...
But I'm a huge fan, yeah.
They get curious, and they're like, that sounds like a good story. I have to try it. All right, last question. You should be able to do this. You worked in restaurants. You consult. You serve a lot of wine. Recommend to me the best wine around $15, $20, $22. Recommend a red. Recommend a white. You can go category. If you think Muscadet is just a great, you know, you can go specific makers. You know, Sicily. Give me your red pick. Give me your white pick. I always say my kids are in their late 20s, early 30s. They're not.
I've been listening to your show long enough that your kids have just.
They're probably 50 now.
Like when this question first started, it was illegal. I'm pretty sure we were contributing to the delinquency of minors.
It's funny you say, you know, I'm so redundant, but I need that setup. It's like you can't show up with a $50 wine if you're going.
I feel like they've graduated to the $35 level personally.
Well,
but I'll still give you something
you want.
For 15.
Give me a red and a white Recco that are great value. Values to quality.
Okay. I would like to try and not be repetitive, but I don't remember what I've answered.
It's okay.
You've heard me say Muscadet for sure. I think that taking it back to Chablis, it's a region that I forget can be so good sometimes. And you know, at the village level, from a good producer who is farming well, you can find some tremendous value there. I think of the wine, the Terroir du Chablis from Beru, I think probably is a little higher than that. Again, I'm trying
spell
to
grad- Beru.
B-E-R-U. I'm trying to graduate Beru. Your kids to the okay. $35 level here. but Brocard comes to mind, B-R-O-C-A-R-D.
Right.
And there's two labels there, the Domaine Brocard or the Julien Brocard. Those kind of tend to fit in that price range. Tremendous values, very saline, delicious, salty wines. It's Chablis, not Chardonnay. Even though it is made from Chardonnay, it's really a wine of place. And I think it offers that complexity for value.
So the difference between, if someone asks you, what's the difference between Chardonnay and Chablis? It's place. It's Chardonnay made in Chablis.
Chardonnay is an ingredient
and everything
in Chablis.
Chablis that affects
if
that
If you think
wine.
About Chablis as the holistic thing, Chardonnay is one piece of it, but not the entirety. Yeah.
All right. So that's,
so I give you.
I back you up on that. Is red harder for you or red is...
Well,
to get in the price range?
Again, I'm going to try and keep myself from being repetitive. I feel certain I've mentioned the Loire, and if I haven't, I should
It doesn't
have.
Matter. That's what you believe.
I'm going to go with Saint-Joseph. I'm coming back into Saint-Joseph drinking season soon. I don't remember when the time changes, but as soon as it's dark by 5 o'clock, I'm going to be ready to drink some Syrah. So I think that if you look at the wines from Julien Session, the
C-E-C-I-L-L-O-N.
Exactly.
He'll be at La Table?
He will be at La Table.
Okay.
He's a tremendous guy, and he makes really delicious wine that's in tremendous value. Again, you know, maybe pushing the high end of 25 going to 30.
Does he make more than Saint-Joseph?
Yes, he does. He makes Cornas. He makes Crows Hermitage. He's a dynamic young guy. Him and his lovely wife, Nancy, are making really, really delicious wines in the Northern Rhone, and I think they're great values.
All right, so... We wound up with Chablis, and we wound up with
Saint-Joseph,
two terrific choices. As I mentioned, I will post as much specifics as you've given me. Let me do a quick wrap-up, and then we're going to have to spend a few minutes on where everyone can get more information or access. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, which I heard is going away, or wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you like the podcast. We would appreciate that. You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and on X at BenRuby. You could always reach us on both through the hashtag TheGrapeNation. We are on Facebook, where I'm finding myself spending very little time on, I hate to say it, at TheGrapeNation.
Facebook still exists.
Right. We'll post Raj's wine list and Daniel's wine that he mentioned and the weekly wine sip, which was the 20-year-old Cote Rhody, on our social media sites. All right. So, Raj, how do we approach this? The question is to find out more information on everything. If there's somebody who says, screw it, I don't care if it's this weekend, where do I find out more about Lafayette de Champagne? I love Rhone wines. That's coming up. Where do I find out? The Paulet thing I went to once 5 years ago, these pressoir dinners, lay it out for me.
Well, the beauty of the modern era is that you don't actually have to know anything. All you have to do is be able to Google, and you don't even have to spell it correctly usually to find us. That having been said, if you started any one of our web landing pages, pressoir.wine, pressoir.wine is a good place to start because that gives you our ongoing programming, but also links you to our festivals and the upcoming.
So singularly, that site will get you.
Each of our websites gives
everywhere.
Access.
Okay.
To exactly.
But start with Pressoir. Linked.
Yeah, we could start with that one.
Because the reason I would say start with Pressoir is there's stuff going on all the time.
Exactly.
You may get there and there's a cool themed dinner 2 weeks from, you know, the day
and,
you did it.
And there are two.
We're Tabli and yeah. all once
in
a
fact,
year.
In fact, between La Fête du Champagne here in New York and after La Fête du Champagne in Houston next week, we'll be having two very cool dinners here in New York City. Which you'll find on the Pressoir.
Is Houston a new market for any of these?
Absolutely. It's our first time doing La Fête there. And it's very exciting, really. It's something we kind of put together last minute in some ways. But
did somebody like kind of pull you? What?
To some degree, yes. We
like,
were
why
originally
are you doing it here?
We were originally going to do a small pop-up after La Fête in a different market, but it was in collaboration with a partner, a resort, and it didn't work out. You know, kind of came apart. Even though we'd done a great deal of work to put together the roster and put the wines in play, because, you know, wine takes a while to get here. So as it started unraveling, I thought to myself, well, maybe we should do it somewhere else. And Daniel and I and the rest of the team started discussing options. I walked out of the office, you know, kind of irritated after one of the calls that made it very clear that this was not going to move forward. And I was walking down the street past one of my other favorite restaurants, Frenchette, when the chef Aaron Bloodhorn, the ex-chef of Cafe Blood here in New York, who now has Bloodhorn and Navy Blue in Houston, Texas, walked out of the restaurant. And him and his operations director, Sharif, who I also worked with, good friends, former colleagues, we just had a grand old time, you know, shooting it and chatting. And then it just struck me a little bit after that. I was like, what if we go to Houston? We've been trying to get, you know, Daniel and the team did an event in Houston in the past around La Paulet, along with one of our partners, American Express. And it was a big success. It's been some years. We wanted to try a new market and we said, why not? You know, we're going for it. We still have tickets available to Houston. So if you're in that part of the country, you should come visit. We're sold out here in New York with the exception of one single ticket for our Bollinger Vieille Vigne Française dinner this
Friday.
Which
is one of the
themes. We're pretty much completely sold
okay.
out.
So if you're in Houston, look for that. La Table coming up in November.
Yep.
La Paulet is next year, earlier in the year.
Yes.
Right.
We'll be in the end of February and the beginning of March, and that'll be in Los Angeles.
All right. And if people want to follow you and they like dogs and guys walking around vineyards, where can they find Raj?
My social media is pretty much limited to Instagram. It's funny. Daniel forced me to make an Instagram back when I was working at Danielle back in the early aughts. He said, you
what
have to be on social
then?
Media. I didn't have anything.
Oh, you didn't. You weren't doing much social.
I wasn't. But I chose the same as my Gmail. So R-A-J-V like Victor, I-N-E. Raj Vine. Daniel is his name, Daniel Johnes,
right.
J-O-H-N-N-E-S. And then you can also follow us at all of the brands that we mentioned,
right.
Pressoir, La Palais, La Table, and La Fête. La Fête's handle is La Fête NYC, even though we sometimes do La Fête outside.
But like
NYC.
You said, even if you go to Google and like, what's that thing called? The La Du Champagne, you know, they'll forget. It'll come up, you know, or La Paulie spelled like Paulie Walnut, you know, it'll come up, you know, they'll find it. So that's where you should go. You should check that stuff. regularly to keep up on the events and certainly to see what Pressoir is doing. I want to thank my guests, Raj Vadia and Daniel Jonas. Daniel had a run out for joining us on The Grape Nation. As always, thanks to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.